Hello, and welcome to another episode of Med Student Voices with the Center for Health Equity Research. We are second-year medical students at UNC School of Medicine. My name is Elgin Yalin.
I'm Rebecca Schaffer.
My name is Amaya Martinez Mesa.
I'm Har Jeng Jata. For today's podcast, we want to talk about the COVID-19 response in rural North Carolina, more specifically Chatham County, using Silo City as our example. The goal of the podcast is to explore how intersectionality affects health outcomes in rural communities and the importance of community resilience in first-line responders in rural North Carolina. Rural communities are defined as communities that have a population density of 250 people per square mile or less. In North Carolina, we have 100 counties. 78 of those are classified as rural. Chatham County itself is bordered by Wake, Orange, Alamance, Moore, Lee, Harnett, and Randolph County. In Silo City, we have a population of 7,848 people based on the 2021 census. 21.9% of the population live under poverty. 28.9% people who are uninsured are under the age of 65. And one of the entities of Silo City is Monterre Chicken Plant. Chatham County has one hospital, which is under UNC Healthcare. Chatham Hospital is a 25-bed critical access hospital that's located in Silo City. Critical access hospitals are hospitals that are at least an hour away from the nearest trauma center, and they provide limited surgical interventions, limited medical, pediatric, and maternity care, and some emergency services. Chatham County had the second confirmed COVID-19 case in North Carolina following Wake in early March of 2020. During the pandemic, some disparities were noted, such as 50% of the confirmed COVID cases were within the Hispanic Latino community, even though they make up 12% of the county's population.
So today we have with us Scotty Weeks, a paramedic from Chatham County. We also have Kaylee Lane Grauman, who was also a paramedic at Chatham County during the pandemic, and Dr. Laura House, a family medicine physician. And we appreciate you guys joining us today.
For our first question, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what your tie is to Chatham County?
Oh, well, I'm Scotty. I was a paramedic for about 2 years before the pandemic came around. I was a field training officer. I still work there currently.
My name's Kaylee Lane. I was a paramedic at Chatham County during the pandemic. I was a paramedic for about 2 years prior to the pandemic hitting. I left Chatham County about a year ago.
My name's Laura House, and I'm a family medicine physician with UNC, and I went to medical school at UNC, graduated way back in 2005, joined UNC Family Medicine in 2008. I started doing inpatient hospital work at Chatham Hospital, which is a critical access hospital in Chatham County. I started that in 2011, and I'm still there. At the time that the pandemic came, I was the director of hospital medicine and was leading a team of hospital physicians in caring for the hospitalized patients that came in, including quite a few COVID patients.
Wonderful. Thank you guys for that. Was there any ties to Chatham County prior to your beginning in your roles in Chatham, or any driving factors that kind of pushed you into rural medicine?
I grew up in Western North Carolina, very, very rural place, very small town, Franklin, North Carolina. So when I went to medical school, or before I even went to medical school, I knew that I wanted to do family medicine, and I really wanted to return kind of back to my home and practice rural medicine, but ended up getting married and staying in the area. So our department, family medicine, has ties with Chatham Hospital. Prior to us starting caring for hospitalized patients there, we provided all the doctors for their emergency room and still do. And so when the opportunity came up through the department to provide hospital medicine in this rural community, because hospital medicine is like absolutely the favorite thing that I do, then I just really wanted to do it and have loved being there and loved working with the community.
How did health disparities and differences in resource access affect your role in the COVID-19 response?
First of all, I don't think any pre-hospital or hospital was ready for a pandemic like this. Our First Health, we needed N95s. all of our N95s, I don't know how long they had had them, but they were dry rotted, the bands were. So those were real scarce. We also had to reuse our N95s because you couldn't get any. Everybody else was ordering them. The people of Chatham County weren't getting the kind of care that they needed on a regular basis for their medical problems because they were scared to go to hospital. So their conditions would be exacerbated by the time that we would get to them. People didn't want to wear masks either. Like, it was political. We would have to gear all the way up if you didn't want to wear a mask. You know, we would have to protect ourselves, doing a code on a possible COVID patient. You had to wear full PPE. That's eyewear, that's face mask, that's a gown, that's foot covers. You had to do that and work this code for 45 some minute. It was exhausting. Our jobs were, some of our coworkers were, they were getting COVID. And so they were staying out of work. And so, you know, the trucks had to be run. So a lot of us would just stay at work because we didn't want to go home anyways and possibly infect our families. And also I was pregnant, so that put me at a high risk. Yeah. Next.
Yeah, I feel like in the beginning of COVID at Chatham, a lot of the times they had us, like Scotty said, reusing the N95s. But initially they're telling us to not use the N95s, gowns, and all that, unless it was a confirmed COVID patient, which it was kind of hard to know that if that was like your initial contact with the patient, and they hadn't even been to the hospital yet, not to gown up, not to use the eye protectant N95, just to wear a surgical mask to the patient's house unless they're confirmed COVID or unless they're receiving a nebulized treatment in the back of your ambulance or CPAP or something like that. And then also for a while, they stopped, I think for like 2 years, they stopped dispatching fire to our emergency calls. I thought that was horrible because that, I feel like, helped our patient care, like it helped us get the patients out of the house quicker.
This is Laura House. So just in general, Chatham County, Siler City is a pretty poor, pretty rural area. There's kind of a lack of access to health care in general before the pandemic. There's, you know, kind of poor health literacy. There's a lack of health insurance among people. So people just in general weren't prone to get good health care before the pandemic. So when people would show up, quite often they had a whole lot of uncontrolled underlying health conditions like diabetes and hypertension and kidney disease. And so these patients tended to get really sick and were very hard to take care of. There's a high rate of tobacco use in the area. So we have a lot of patients with lung disease, COPD. These patients would get very sick. And we have a high Latino population because it's a very rural area. So there's farming, there's kind of service work that's there that people don't tend to do unless they're not able to get other jobs. And unfortunately, Latinos would be taken advantage of by having them work in these service jobs where they don't get any insurance. Some of them might be undocumented, so they don't have any health insurance. They don't have any access to health care. They would be forced to work in conditions that were not safe or healthy. They would be, you know, packed into a workplace with no PPE side by side with other people. These are people who don't have any type of sick time that they can take. They have to feed their families. And so they would be forced to come to work when they were sick, and it spread like wildfire through the Latino community in Siler City. There was a lot of misinformation, as was mentioned before, regarding people not wearing to wear masks. I would say over 90% of our people that we admitted to the hospital were not vaccinated because there was a lot of political misinformation going around about vaccines, and this misinformation was spread through fear. And so our first waves of people coming in were just absolutely devastating. We would see people that should have been otherwise healthy young Latinos coming in that were in respiratory failure, and they literally filled our hospital. Every bed we had in our hospital, we were boarding people in the ED, and we, because of lack of, you know, access to kind of higher levels of care, we were trying to get them transferred, but nobody had beds to transfer these people to. And it was just absolutely horrific, you know, watching people that should have never gotten this sick get this sick and sometimes die and being unable to do anything about it. And I honestly joke about this with my kids, but it's really not a joke that, you know, when I'm older and I have grandkids, some people come back and ask me, oh, you were on the front lines during the pandemic. How was that? I will honestly, you know, have a very PTSD-like reaction to that and say, I really don't want to talk about it, because just seeing what happened and watching even after weeks and months of the pandemic and people getting sick and dying and people still refusing to get vaccinated, still refusing to wear masks was very, very hard. And we had to work nonstop because we had to have like three layers of coverage to make sure that if one of us got sick, that there was, or if we got, you know, like overwhelmed, that somebody else could come in and cover if we were unable to work. And so we were basically either on the schedule or on call all the time.
Hey, Dr. Laura, I would like to ask a follow-up question. So I remember one night I was in a Chatham ICU, and we had a 22-year-old Latino that we were getting ready to transfer to Chapel Hill. And I was like wondering, like, how did he get this sick so fast? But my question was also like, if he was at Chapel Hill, would this happen? So from your counterpart of like people who are in the urban versus the rural area, did you think it was more like resources, or it was more the lack of access?
So I think, yes, patients got sick very, very fast, and they got sick regardless of whether they were in a big medical center or not. I think what we were dealing with, though, was certainly worsened by a lack of healthcare literacy and more poverty, a lack of insurance, and a lack of like general health care and being healthy underlying. But certainly, yes, big medical centers also saw those people. And I think in terms of lack of access at Chatham, we did not have ICU doctors. We didn't have, you know, initially access to the medications that you would need to treat people. And actually, of course, the way that we treated people certainly changed throughout the pandemic as we learned, you know, what helped keep people alive. But being in a hospital where you have nursing shortages and medication shortages and respiratory therapy shortages and inability to care for a patient that was that sick and not being able to transfer them anywhere certainly resulted in some, you know, not ideal outcomes for some people.
I know Kaylee and Scotty talked a bit of people not wanting to wear masks and kind of like misinformation in the community. What were some of the things that people were saying or like didn't understand about the virus? Like, could you talk a little bit about that when you were doing house visits to people that had called in?
People didn't really understand that quarantine means that you really needed to stay home. You know, you can get it and pass it out in public by not washing your hands, coughing, talking to each other. Whenever we did respond to houses, though, there were six different things that we would try to get you to stay home if you didn't have these six different things. And that was if you were pregnant, you had heart failure, diabetes, if you were severely obese, over 60, those made you high risk for COVID. And if you had a fever and respiratory issues or fever, really, you know, it was suspect for COVID. So we would transport those people. But other people, we tried to get them to stay home. We'd give them Tylenol. You know, we told them how to treat themselves. We gave them a piece of paper to call this COVID hotline to educate themselves, because we didn't really know a whole lot about it either. We tried to educate people where we could. Well, at least that's what I do. The not wearing the mask, you know, people say, oh, I can't breathe. Yeah, well, I don't want your COVID either. You know, we were stuck in a confined box with these people in the ambulance, you know, geared all the way up. We were extremely uncomfortable. We're in the summertime. It was horrendous. I hated a respiratory call during summer of 2020. We were exhausted. We were nasty. Oh, my God. You'd sweat.
It was terrifying. And I can't imagine how terrifying it must have been being pregnant at the beginning of a pandemic when they had no idea how it would affect pregnant women or their baby. Yeah. I remember coming home and like making sure before I came in the house, I would come in through the garage, I would take all of my clothes off, and I would go to the utility sink, and I would put all my clothes in like a plastic bag and leave them in the garage. I would go to the utility sink and I would basically soap and water scrub myself, you know, on the whole upper half of my body, and then go in the house, trying to stay 6 feet away from everybody, go straight to the shower, take a shower, put on clean clothes because I didn't want to bring it home to my kids and my family.
Absolutely. I did the same thing.
You mentioned a lot of kind of unknowns throughout the pandemic. Do you feel like some of these unknowns kind of created mistrust in the rural community for like healthcare, or kind of understanding the next steps in the pandemic or how things would progress?
I think you mean mistrust from the rural community. I totally think so, because with the information coming down, that would change. It created a lot of mistrust, and there was already a tendency for mistrust in a lot of these people to begin with. I would have people tell me that, no, I don't have COVID. You're lying to me. They thought that, you know, it was all just like a conspiracy. And, you know, and even if they did believe COVID was real, then it wasn't any more dangerous than a cold, and that the vaccine would kill you, and that they're trying to implant you with microchips and just all kinds of stuff that was spreading throughout the community. And so anytime, you know, any announcement was made that changed the way that things were done, changed recommendations, then people were like, see, I told you, they don't, you know, they're just lying to us. And there was a lot of mistrust, and it was very painful because we're used to being able to help people and provide them with information to try to, you know, benefit them. And when that kind of trust is broken down and people don't believe that you're treating them for something that they actually have, or believe that maybe you're trying to hurt them, it really gets at the core of what you went into medicine to do. It's really a hard thing to deal with.
Yeah, that sounds really difficult. You mentioned there is a large Spanish-speaking population in the area. I was kind of curious, like, how was that messaging tailored to the Spanish-speaking community? And, like, what was the interpreter staff like at the hospital?
So in the beginning, I know we had like in-person interpreters, and we and UNC both, I think, had, you know, several interpreters actually get sick with COVID. And so they started recommending that they not go into the rooms with COVID patients because they just felt like the risk of, you know, getting interpreters sick was not worth it. So we did end up having try to provide care with them, maybe standing at the outside of the room, or with like a electronic, you know, like iPad interpreter or a phone line, and do feel like that didn't provide certainly as good of communication as you would like to have with people. I do also feel that the Latino population, perhaps working in situations where their supervisors and overseers might be providing misinformation for them, so that would be their only access to information, you know, so that I felt like that was definitely happening in certain cases where some of the Latino population would talk about how they didn't want to get a vaccine because they heard this, that, and the other about it, you know, being dangerous. And I felt like that was kind of propagating maybe from their employers or, you know, other people in the community.
I had a question. So did you feel like the rural community was represented within the people who were making the policies? And
so I definitely think that the policies that were coming down, like stimulus checks, did not benefit people who were undocumented, right? And a lot of these people were at super high risk of getting very sick and had no access to insurance or healthcare. I do know that being associated, Chatham Hospital is associated with UNC, it's owned by UNC. And so kind of the higher levels of folks at UNC did, and they always have, tried to provide care for everyone in the community. So they have what's called charity care or patient assistance programs. So they provide care for people, whether they're documented or not, whether they have insurance or not, whether they're able to pay their bills or not. So on that kind of local level, you know, we were trying to get assistance for people and help them. But certainly at the federal level, which is where you would hope a lot of help would come from, I think these people really got left behind.
I think that kind of leads us nicely into the next question. What would you want to see for the future in response to another pandemic, whether it's like within the EMS team or the hospital or even like the federal, kind of programs that we saw when we were in the pandemic, which we still are, but what sort of things would you want to see in a future response?
I feel like more preparedness, like have set policies in place and set, like, because they would come out with a policy at work and then they would change it 2 weeks later. Supplies, like have better access to the supplies we need to protect ourselves and our patients.
It feels like there was such a reactive response to the pandemic, right? I think infectious disease experts had been saying for many, many years that we were overdue for a large pandemic and nobody was prepared when this came, even though the likelihood of it happening was certainly there. So I would like to see a more proactive response than reactive response, right? Being prepared to begin with. And then I feel like the response was not coordinated at a federal level. So everything from the get-go was passed down to state authorities, like testing and supplies, and it became a competition between states to try to get enough supplies and try to figure out how to get people tested to see, you know, if they actually had COVID. And it became really, it felt like the Hunger Games sometimes, and that everybody was competing for resources, and they really needed to have a more coordinated response and things that were set down from a federal level and then passed from the federal level down to help states organize and take care of their populations. I would agree that we needed better support. We needed a lot more information that went out that was not misinformation. It felt like that people were trying to, you know, hide the severity of the pandemic a lot of times, and that just propagated misinformation and made it harder for us to do our jobs. And I would have liked to see them take care of the people that were actually working a lot better, because a lot of us were working nonstop, and it was very much after the fact when there came the great resignation, you know, like people started quitting in droves because we had been doing this for so long and we were so burned out by the work, so traumatized by that work that we couldn't do it anymore. And then the pandemic's still going on and the people that are left behind were not getting anything, and people were leaving their jobs and moving to other hospitals or moving to locums companies in order to get paid a lot more money. And whereas the people who stayed behind and tried to remain loyal to the places where they were working were no benefit from doing that. And so it just really created this crisis in healthcare staffing and providing healthcare.
Since we kind of talked about like PTSD and how difficult it was with burnout, how did you take care of yourself during the time when you were working in the early on in the pandemic, even now?
Well, for me, my coworkers were really like a family, and they would literally go to a call for me if it was a respiratory call or a confirmed case call. They tried to take care of me. The transfer from a hospital came out. They took care of me, you know, so I didn't have to sit in the back. They tried to reduce my risk, which I thank them all the time. I was emotional. We didn't really have any kind of management for our psychological problems that were coming out of this. I'd like to see that. Maybe we needed to do an angle on our psychological health and how it really did affect us. I mean, it was true fear that I've never, can you imagine going into somebody's house that's sick and you have to take them if they're sick and expose yourself and your family if you go home? And not only that, like what if it's stuck to your clothes and the next patient that you go to, you know, didn't have COVID and now might could get COVID because of you? I felt dirty. Like I felt like I was a disease carrier, and I hated wearing my uniform. I hated being an EMS. I love my job, but I hated that it made me feel dirty like that. I really did.
That's a great perspective, Scotty. because I think a lot of us felt that way. We felt dirty. We felt contaminated all the time. I didn't want to be around other people. I was afraid to be around other people. And the fear, the guilt of thinking that I might have made anybody sick. For me, it was my family and my coworkers that were the best support that I had, for sure. I worked to make a schedule that provided like three layers so that if anybody got sick, that we could cover for them and allow people to get rest in between the shifts that they were working. I tried to, you know, sleep when I had the opportunity because sleep is so important. And it was really hard to do what I typically do for my like wellness. Like you could go outside to get some exercise, but like I like to go get massages or pedicures. To kind of, you know, like help me relax and get my mind off of things. And all of those things were shut down. It was really hard. And in the beginning, and still, there's really not good access to mental health care to try to work through a lot of the trauma and the fear that we had to go through.
Thank you for sharing all of that. I know it was a very difficult time.
To wrap up, here are a few points retained from this episode. Hispanic and Latinx individuals make up more than 50% of confirmed COVID-19 cases in Chatham County, even though they make up around 12% of the county's population. This disparity was propelled by the recent establishment of a poultry processing plant in 2019 in Siler City, which employs a high number of Hispanic and Latinx individuals. The close working conditions of such processing plants facilitated the spread of COVID-19, leading to the largest proportion between the county's population and those affected by the virus. It is important to recognize that the same group of people is largely under and uninsured. In the future, we would like to interview public health figures from Chatham's health department to learn about the specifics of the response plan. We would like to thank Dr. Harris for leading this course as part of SHS3 at UNC School of Medicine. Please see our episode description for mental health resources. If you're hearing this message, you have listened to our new episode all the way to the end, and for that, we're very grateful. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you did, we encourage you to share with others who might be interested in this topic.